So, what if it were the end of the world as we know it? What would you be prepared to do? And I say not the end of the world, just the end of the world as we know it. What if all infrastructure broke down? What if there was, what if electricity, were to be cut off for a prolonged period of time? What if water, municipal water flow, like what's happening in Atlanta right now, we're in jeopardy right now. Lake Lanier, which is the reservoir that provides water to Atlanta, is down to catastrophic levels. I mean, if it goes down any lower, there just isn't going to be any water for a city the size of Atlanta. I mean, what if there were earthquakes? What if there were hurricanes? How could you survive any number of calamities? Well, it's first of all, it's always nice to have that Sea Crane calamity kit too, which, well, I didn't mean to sneak in a commercial, but it is really cool. But if you don't have the infrastructure that you're used to depend on, then what? Well, that's the premise of the book, When All Hell Breaks Loose. It's new from Cody London. Next, we'll explore it on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Cody London, I'm looking at your photo on the back of your book, and I look at my photo, and if you just looked at my photo and your photo, we would know that I wouldn't survive and you would.
Hi, Ian.
Just based on your photo alone, I know that you're going to survive. Be prepared, not scared. That's Cody's theme, and I think it's a good one. As you're writing this book, and we can talk about 98.6 too, to a degree, but When All Hell Breaks Loose is the new book. As you're writing this, do you ever calculate what are the odds that these types of things might happen to the average reader?
As far as the calamity itself?
Yeah, as to, any of these circumstances.
Oh, I think it's very, very probable that they will happen, and that's part of the reason, obviously, that I wrote the book.
Okay, well, you say very probable, meaning that at some time in the life of your average reader for this book, something so catastrophic might happen that they would need the information that you have.
Yeah, either really catastrophic or not catastrophic. I mean, think about it. My generation and younger, catastrophic is we don't have email for a day. Because our mindset sucks nowadays in America. We've been dumbed down so much. What I did, if you notice in the book, is I didn't put a cap on the poop hits the fan, this bad or this bad. That's kind of irrelevant. What I tried to categorize is what's going to kill you. What's going to kill you first and how to mitigate that. So, yeah, this book will help if the grid totally shuts down. And this book will help, like here in Arizona during monsoon season, if the lightning just takes out a transformer for 6 hours or a day and you don't have power. The bottom line is, it's the duration is kind of irrelevant in a way, but the book helps either way.
All right, well, let's talk about that because I do think duration is the key in some respects, at least where, say, I'm here in the upper Midwest, and I often think about that. I mean, how long would it take before I would, have to go to start making sort of extraordinary means to keep the family together or to keep, the family processes, working all right. So, I mean, I would think, I don't know. I would think probably 2 or 3 days or 4 days without water. I mean, if like in the case of Atlanta where the water supply just dries up, what could people do? What's the first thing you do? Because water is one of our basic needs.
Yeah, move.
Yeah.
Get out of Atlanta, sell your home. Yeah, that's a basic foundational, gotta have it cellular level type goody, water. It's
Right.
not an option. And but the parameters that are thrown out there are quite often by survival instructors and books, that this was, 3 days without water and 4 weeks without food and whatever.
Right.
Those are all real rough guesstimates. In the desert here, you can die of dehydration in a few hours if you do something stupid like try to dig your truck out of a wash at noon. So in regards to answering your question, man, I mean it's I mean a few days. I mean it's a bad situation. I read about that too, and I just when I come here to Arizona, I just got back from a road tour from Seattle and Portland. I just flew in about 2 hours ago, so pardon me if I'm a little bit. I have two Coca-Colas here to that pulled me through.
To get you through.
But, you know, the fountains are going here in Arizona, and the zillions of golf courses. When I flew in the jet over Phoenix, once again, every other house has a pool in the backyard. So it's ironic that you know, there's just a basic lack of respect for what it takes to stay alive in this country, I think because we've had it too damn easy for too long.
All right. Well, then we'll talk a little bit about your survival school too coming up in a few minutes. But then walk us through. I mean, you talk about staying alive. What's our biggest threat to life almost immediately? What should we be aware of right out of the box?
Right out of the box is thermoregulation. And that's my first book, 98.6 Degrees, Art of Keeping Your Ass Alive, which you referenced. Your core, Ian, and my core body temperature, give or take, is 98.6 degrees. The biggest cause of death in an outdoor survival situation is hypothermia, low body temperature, or hyperthermia, high body temperature. Now, you might say, well, you know, what in the hell does that have to do with the urban survival situation? Well, about in 2004, just a few years ago, do you remember when they had that huge heat wave in Europe?
Sure.
Yeah, it knocked out about 60,000 people who died in their home or apartments all over Europe. So body temperature regulation is key. You know, a human being is like a car. You know, if it doesn't have the radiator, the radiator's leaking, or the radiator doesn't work, you don't go down the road. So that is primary. Let's say, you know, it's your Midwest and the power gets knocked out and you don't have a wood stove. All of a sudden it's 35 degrees in the house. So we're dealing with thermoregulation as your primary number one thing to do. Of course, after ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation, and the billions of injuries that could happen, especially in an urban calamity.
Well, okay. Well, we can even go closer to home. Remember what happened in Chicago? Was it summer of 95, maybe, where Chicago, which is not unaccustomed to heat. I mean, that's a city that's used to hot summers, but it got nailed with a heat wave, and it cost the lives of, I want to say, hundreds of people who died, as similar to the European situation, in their apartments. Sometimes people these dying sitting in front of the window with a fan on. But they said this went to a kind of complacency where people had survived it in the past, so they thought they were naturally just going to survive it again in the future. But there was a tipping point, and they lost.
Yeah, and that's, you know, survival's a gamble. That's the nature of the word, survival. Survival sucks. You know, no one wants to be in that situation where your life is on the line. It tends to cause extreme fear. It's a bummer. It's a buzzkill. You know, it's a, hopefully just a short-term situation. And, yeah, just got last summer, too. Again, that's very, very, very common, lack of thermoregulation, even in towns and cities. And when I came out with that first book, people were going, you know, I like that information, and I think it's cool, but I don't really go outside that much, you know,
right.
So I don't need that book. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, that book, a lot of that information could have been used in the backyard as well. But then, you know, when all hell breaks loose, that's your backyard primer right there. So people just don't think. And the reason they don't think is because the damn little thing on the wall with the little temperature gauge that is, you know, it's 72 degrees and it'll always be 72 degrees. And again, you nailed it on the head, complacency and a desire for comfort. It's the bugaboo of America, big time. And it's going to bite us in the butt sooner or later.
Or even panic, and I thought that's an interesting idea too. Is that's the first thing you have to do is fight the panic, because maybe that's also how some people, you know, died in Chicago with that summer heat wave. Is they kind of panicked and they forgot. It's sort of like how, you know, they will find somebody who's been lost in the desert, and when ultimately they find them, they were a half mile from the highway, right? When they find the body, they were a lot closer to so-called civilization than they realized, but something happened and they were unable to make the leap that ultimately saved their life.
Yeah, panic is much more than a psychological state of, you know, high-level stress or fear. I mean, panic is pretty much that's when all the warning bells go off and the person just goes willy-nilly running to the woods, and it's a complete breakdown of the psyche in general. But it also has some physiological ramifications, big time. You know, just it impairs the circulatory system, which, guess what? That's how the body heats and cools itself. So it's not just a psychological state that causes one to lock up in a panic state. It directly affects your physiology and even more so body temperature regulation. So when you really get into the physics of survival, and the psychology and physiology of survival, it's a very, very fascinating field. And when you look at that, how fear and alt stress affect the body, and you look at what other survival people teach, you realize a lot of it's bogus. You know, it's based on fine and complex motor skills, which are going to go to a hell in a handbasket when your heart rate goes up, which when you're scared, your heart rate goes up. So again, it's right. Knowing, I mean, my body is what I'm trying to keep alive, for God's sake. But it's ironic that how few people put that into the factor, you know, when, you know, when push comes to shove, or they're training someone in survival.
All right. So what's the most likely scenario in the life of the average person, the most likely scenario that they're going to face that they need to survive? I mean, we're talking about hurricanes or floods?
Oh, yeah.
Or
my crystal ball broke a long time ago. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. Statistically speaking, I mean, what is it that you, as you were right, because, I mean, you go through a lot of various scenarios. I was just curious whether you've heard or came across, you know, the average person will most likely face a tornado, or the average person will most likely face, you know, being caught in a thunderstorm. I was just curious.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. Obviously, I did a heck of a lot of research for this
book.
Yeah,
you did.
I never ran across a stat like that.
Okay.
You know, we don't even have a stat for how many people get rescued by search and rescue nationwide. No one even keeps that basic of a stat, let alone. Well, we could just go down, you know, I'm a news junkie, you know, Google
right.
News, CNN, whatever, because I like to track this stuff. This is my passion. Self-reliance is what I do. It's what I live. It's how I make my living, blah, blah, blah. And you can just see the weather systems, the hurricanes, and the tornadoes, and earthquakes. And, you know, I was just in Seattle and Portland, like I mentioned, and they are there on a fault line, on the ring of fire, you know, with volcanic activity, with wind storms, and that's part of the reason I was received so well up there, is because they realize that they're in a real hell on earth type place if push comes to shove. So
how it
happens, who knows, you know?
Well, let's push
a wild card.
Let's push it there. Let's talk about Seattle specifically, or the Northwest in general, or even for that matter, down the coasts, which would be the most vulnerable. Let's say worst case scenario, you have an earthquake, which then also results in a tsunami, which accompanies, let's say there's a particularly bad storm. You get kind of a perfect storm of two or three things happening at once in Seattle. What's the first thing people should do?
Well, I mean, it depends on how quickly they're notified. Okay, for an earthquake, I know they have some centers out there, but there might be no notification for that. For a tsunami, what is it, a half an hour? For a hurricane, a few days? So let's take Katrina, because that happened. That wasn't hypothetical at all. And you had a two- or three-day, yeah, they botched it, but you had a two- or three-day window there. Get out of there, you know, if you can get out of there. But then people tried to, and what was the gridlock, 6-7 hours on the highway?
Right.
So if you can avoid a punch coming at your face, you get out of the way. You know, that's basic common sense survival.
Right.
But a lot of people won't be able to do that. So the next thing is, you know, is your home still standing? You know, were you all at home? What if Ian's in the studio and your sweetheart's back home or whatever? You know, you need to have a game plan via communication where Ian and his loved ones say, look, if something goes on and we don't have any communication, we're going to meet here. And then we'll go to plan B after we meet here. So I'd say that's the first thing, is to gather the troops, metaphorically speaking, and find out what's happening. You know, if you can't avoid the punch and you get hit with the punch, then you got to decide what the damage is after you're punched. And then you go into that part of the disaster thing.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, then let's kick it back to Katrina then. If you knew that you couldn't get out and you knew that you were going to have to survive some sort of both either the hurricane or the after effects of the hurricane in New Orleans, what would have been the first things you would have done? What would you have grabbed? What would you have attempted to, I mean, you know, knowing that you couldn't get out, what would you have done to try to prepare yourself to survive?
Well, if I couldn't get out, as you're saying, and I had to be in my home, I mean, yeah, people should have a bug out kit with basic supplies. Maybe we can talk about that later. But I would have hoped, since I lived in a hurricane zone and that this not the first time that this happened, that I would have had the foresight to reinforce my house and do all the doodads that the builders can do to make that more prone to withstanding a storm, and then have the disaster supplies on hand, alternative lighting, alternative sanitation and communications, food, potable water, ways to disinfect water, all the stuff I outline in the book, just common sense stuff. I'd want to have that on hand, because what I don't want to do is head to the Astrodome or whatever, wherever all those people went and the carnage started. You know, but think about New Orleans. If everyone was on the same page and everyone had basic disaster skills and a mindset, here we go back to the psychology again, and the goodies to back it up in the home, there would have been no Astrodome or whatever. There would have, you know, they would have just, you know, everyone would have been on the same page. So that's what I would have hoped to do, you know, deal with my shelter. If I'm in a disaster area, beef it up as much as possible, okay. Have disaster supplies on hand.
All right. So let's say you suspect the flood is coming. And so you wonder whether you're below sea level and you don't even know whether or not you're going to have a home. But you think, you suspect you might have some roof space and you're hoping to be recovered in the next couple of days. If going back, you know, knowing what happened to the Katrina victims, you know, happened, what would you have done differently? What would you have grabbed in the house and brought up with you to the roof to help you survive?
I would have had shelter materials, you know, extra clothing, sleeping bags. I would have had water, and I would have had a way to disinfect water. I mean, they were surrounded with water, but they couldn't drink it, you know.
How do you disinfect it?
What's that?
How do you disinfect it without having, say, access to a flame?
Oh, sodium hypochlorite 5.2 or 6%, basic household bleach, tincture of iodine 2%, povidone iodine 10%. You know, there's even UV radiation in my part of the world, and I think in New Orleans too. A 2-liter pop bottle, you know, those just flimsy plastic pop bottles that Coke comes in or Pepsi comes in.
Right.
One of those emptied, filled with water, set in the sun for 6 hours for my latitude, the UV radiation and direct sunlight disinfects that in 6 hours. So here we have a bunch of junk with bottles floating around with a bunch of people on the roofs waving at news helicopters when they had the water right there and they had the containers right there, but they didn't have the know-how to do it. I found that highly ironic that could have – how many people died, you know, because
right.
They didn't have enough water, and they had the means right there, no flame required.
Right, no flame required. So that would be, you would say, in every home should have what? Then a bottle of iodine and a bottle of bleach handy, plus the formula to know how much to put in so you don't turn it into poison.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of ways to disinfect water, but what I tried to outline in the book is stuff that people probably do have at home. I mean, who doesn't have chlorine bleach in the house? Pretty much everyone has that. You don't want it with the phosphates. You don't want it with the scents. It's, you know, you could get a gallon of generic bleach for $2. I just bought one for TV shows up in Seattle. And you want to get into disinfection? This is so nice to have, other than a soundbite, to talk about a 450-page book. Let's talk about, okay, so you have 1 quart of water. Okay, let's say you have 1 quart. It's a little bit less than a liter. If I had chlorine bleach, I would use 2 to 4 drops, fill the bottle with water, maybe filter it through a bandana, get all the sediment out if there's sediment in the water, which now needs to be disinfected. Take 2 to 4 drops of chlorine bleach, put it in the quart water bottle, and let it sit for 30 minutes. If you crack it open and it does not smell like chlorine, add a couple more drops, let it sit for 30 minutes, crack the top of the bottle open, let some disinfected water dribble down the threads, and you should be good to go for the major application of what most urban people are going to be into. That's one way to disinfect water.
All right. Urban survival, we're just getting started. Be prepared, not scared. And Cody, you say Lundeen, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, I said London earlier. Cody Lundeen, When All Hell Breaks Loose, Stuff You Need to Survive When Disaster Strikes, next on Coast to Coast AM. When All Hell Breaks Loose, Cody Lundeen, the author also of 98.6 Degrees. We'll come back. We'll talk about urban survival. You know, much is made about what you could build, or, you know, if you were to have your own well for water or just to be living life off the grid. And that's great if that's what you can do and you can afford to do that. And yet, when a disaster strikes, how can you be prepared? What is it that you need to know? He knows it all. We'll get to it next on Coast to Coast AM. All right, Cody Lundin was talking about if he had been at New Orleans when Katrina struck, what he would have brought with him up on the roof. We talked about just the basic thing like water. But all right, so you got water, and then what? I mean, you're going to build some shelter because obviously you're going to worry a little bit about the sun. And if you didn't grab a tarp or something on your way up to the roof. Any suggestions?
Oh, a garbage bag, 55-gallon drum liner, clothing. I mean, in my desert survival courses, when we're moving in the heat of the day, and that's part of the point of the course, is, to stress out my students, it's not like we're having we don't have a tarp that we're carrying. Just use a hat, long sleeve shirt, sunscreen, sunglasses, long pants, whatever it takes. I mean, clothing is your first line of defense to regulate body temperature in the wintertime for hypothermia and also in the summertime for hyperthermia. So it's the wonder thing that no one really likes to talk about because it's frankly kind of boring to most people. It's not as pizzazzy as survival is supposed to be.
Right. Okay. And then what about food? If you didn't bring any up with you, what could you do urban wise to survive without, say, a grocery store?
For how long?
Well, you tell me.
Well, let's
3 days, 6 days?
Let's do the Katrina thing. FEMA says 3 days, right? And that got proved wrong with Katrina. So food is not a priority in short-term survival. It never was. It never will be, with certain exceptions in cold weather survival where the metabolic heat produced from consuming food helps regulate core body temperature. Again, we're back to 98.6. But that's the big thing. People fixate on the food. And, yes, it's uncomfortable not to have stuff to eat, but it's – food doesn't do a corpse a lot of good. If you're dead from other factors, I don't care how much food you have on the roof. And canned goods, since we're talking about food, that's kind of the no-brainer easy way for a family to store food. Yes, there's all these expensive companies with dehydrated and MREs and whatnot, and if you have a bunch of money, yeah, they're great. But canned goods last an average of 2 years per can. You can write the date right on them. I can show you how to open a can on a concrete wall. A can opener is obviously a lot easier.
Right.
But you can open them other ways and just dig in with a stick or chopsticks or whatever. They don't need it to be heated. It doesn't need to be cooked. It's ready to rock and roll. And they're fairly cheap. So I wouldn't want canned goods in a bug-out pack because of the weight, but it's kind of a no-brainer for general
sure.
food storage.
Okay, but let me back up for a second because you said something about food, and I was watching Man versus Wild or Survivor Man or one of those shows, and I thought they made a really interesting point. You could comment on either of those programs if you want to, but I thought the guy made a really good point. I can't remember if it was Bear Grylls or who the other guy is, but he said that food isn't so much a matter of filling up your belly as it is a psychological reassurance that everything's going to be okay. And I think that speaks to something you get to in the book, is the psychology of survival, putting yourself in a mindset where you know you can do this.
Yeah, that's obviously hugely important because the psychology rules the physiology to a large extent. But if you pick the slice of chocolate cake over the parka in the wintertime, you're dead. So there's got to be some semblance of common sense in the hierarchical needs. And now, okay, what are those? Because we've been doing these 20 questions things about what should I do? And we could do that, the rest of the night for sure. But that, because I get asked a lot, well, what should I do if blah, blah, blah? And I go, well, how do I know? Because what anyone has to do, and Americans are frustrated with this because they want to take a course and have it be done with. I want to buy my insurance and not have to think about this, but any emergency situation that comes up, you're going to have to roll with the punches about that and decide, okay, what's going to kill me and my family first? How do I mitigate that? Maybe it's transportation. Maybe just moving out of the way of the punch is what saves your life, and you didn't have to get into your 60-pound supply of survival goods. Maybe it's thermoregulation. Maybe it's dehydration. There's all these different factors that are frustrating because one has to think for oneself. And the best way to do that is through repetitive training, even if it's in your head, or taking a course, or reading several books, or at least realizing, wow, this could happen to me and my family, and get out of this kind of funk denial stage that a lot of America's in. You know, September was National Preparedness Month, right? And so we waved a few flags and ate some apple pie and did nothing. And according to the American Red Cross, a recent stat is that less than 7% of Americans are prepared for disaster. Ian, less than 7%. That's fairly pathetic.
Well, I don't want to be among them. So, I want to go back to that psychological question, because not that you dodged it, but I thought the point that they made in Survivor Man, or whatever that show was on Discovery, was that even if you had a little bit of food, even if you created food out of nothing, where you're trapping a fish using a shirt and a stick to make a net, and you can have a little bit of food, is that it triggers a psychological response that can make the difference between giving up and going on. And so I was thinking about that when I was reading the bit about the first step, you know, and you know, in either of the books, you're talking about not panicking or not sending out the kind of negative thing that would come back to you and haunt you, that would somehow get you in a place where you think, there's no way I can win this.
Yeah, and I agree with that comment. What I want to just caution you and your listeners on is, you know, if I blow 350 calories to catch a 10-calorie grasshopper to make my psychology feel better, you're in a deficit. You know, so there has to be some common sense.
Okay.
It's a lot easier to use and lose the glucose by thinking about something and realizing, you know, is this worth it? Is this worth it? Because every time I move my body, I chew through calories and water, and those can be very, very hard to come by, especially in the backcountry of the wilderness, let alone an urban situation where there's a total breakdown.
All right, so what are the cheap psychological tricks you recommend that we can play on ourselves so that we could not expend more calories than we bring in and yet get the same benefit of thinking I can win this?
The cheap tricks, I like that.
Yeah.
Be prepared, for one, okay?
Okay.
I mean, this whole book is about proper preparation. I don't care what people watch on TV. You know, if you want to base your preparedness plan on a television show, then you're going to leave the gene pool, okay? And then, not that there's tidbits that can't be picked up, but I'd want to, any sort of indigenous people, any Native American or Bushman or whatever, they always were as prepared as they possibly could, because this isn't a game. You know, this isn't a fun hobby or a television show. This is your life, and this is what we're doing here. To get back to the psychology thing, party on is what I used in 98.6. It's like the ultimate mantra that knows no negative connotation with that. And the mindset, you know, you've got to be prepared, but have the positive mindset, the will to live. There's been a lot of research done on that. I totally agree with that. But part of what makes that will to live is being prepared and thinking through these situations beforehand, instead of expecting to just pull this rabbit out of the hat because I saw it on TV. I mean, there's going to be an awful lot of dead people that watch too much TV, in my opinion, because they're buying what's supposed to be largely entertainment.
Okay. What would you have me then have in my house right now? What are the items that you think every household should have for urban survival?
Okay, yeah, good. Okay, I'm gonna sound like a broken record here, but you need to regulate core body temperature.
Right.
So if Ian has a home that cannot be alternatively heated or cooled, Meaning if your home gets cold, kicking and screaming from the grid for whatever reason,
right?
You got to be able to heat and cool that thing.
Okay, so let's say I've got a fireplace. Does that count as alternative heat?
Yes. Do you have wood?
I have some wood, and I have furniture.
You bet. Have you cleaned the flue in the chimney out recently?
Yes.
Okay, good. Because what most people are going to do is they have the fireplace, they don't really use it. Meanwhile, three squirrels have built a nest. They're going to stoke it up during disaster. If not, die of carbon monoxide. They're going to burn their house down. There's going to be a lot of stuff like that happen because people don't think and they don't maintain this stuff. So, okay, so you've got a fireplace. That's cool. I don't know, you know, need to know the town, but what state do you live in?
Minnesota.
Okay, I used to live in Bloomington.
Okay, so I would have lived right by you.
Okay, so I remember mosquitoes as big as poodles,
yep.
And kind of muggy summers, but not that big of a deal, right, if you don't
right.
have any air conditioning?
It's actually the summers have gotten warmer and the winters have gotten milder over the years.
Okay, yeah, even though global warming's a myth, but that's a different conversation.
I'm just saying, it just has. The winters have gotten a lot milder. People in the upper Midwest complain the ice isn't as thick as it used to be, it doesn't freeze as long as it used to, and there's some meteorological statistics to back that up, where
wow.
there are more and more pickup trucks are going through the ice during ice fishing season because it's over a lot faster than people are prepared for.
That's a bummer. But you know, everyone has that room in the house that's always cooler during the summertime. What I outline when all hell breaks loose is finding microhabitats in your home. You know, find that north-facing room that's shaded or whatever that's automatically cooler. Cold air sinks. A lot of this is physics, convection radiation, about how objects, human or otherwise, heat up or cool down on planet Earth. It's fascinating about how the sciences work in regards to survival. So, okay, you regulate core body temperature. The easiest way for Ian to do that, that's a gross motor skill that he can do under extreme stress, is he puts on clothes or he takes clothes off, depending on if it's hot or cold. You have the extra sleeping bag, blankets. You said you have your fireplace. You've maintained that fluid chimney. You have fuel wood, even if it's busting up the kitchen table. So you're good to go on regulating core body temperature. The next thing I would want is water. And I don't want to prioritize it and make it in stone and have your listeners jotting down with their pens because they got to be able to roll and think with common sense. But Ian needs stored water. I know land of 10,000 lakes, but that might be the least of your problems. But as the corpse floats by in lake whatever,
right.
you need a way to disinfect that water. And we've talked about common household bleach. We've talked about tincture of iodine 2%. There's contraindications, which means don't use it to at least that tincture of iodine. You have lots of wood, probably, right? You know,
right.
At least there's, I remember just amazing woods when I was a kid just to get lost in and have a blast. So even if you have a pot from the kitchen and you're boiling it, you can boil, you can distill, you can pasteurize water, you can use the halogens we've already talked about. In my part of the world, you can use UV radiation. So what I would want Ian to have is two or three ways to disinfect your water, okay, to make it, you know, you might not need to store it. I need to store it. I need to know where it is because I'm a desert kid. But you might just say, hey, this is good to go, or we got a creek in our backyard or whatever.
Right.
But is it safe to drink or not? The next thing is, where do you poop? Okay, if Ian's toilet doesn't work and he can't go to the bathroom in his house anymore, what do you do with that? You know, because a huge cause, probably the leading cause of death in developing nations all over the world from lack of sanitation is dysentery, you know, from contaminated water. So we don't want, imagine if all your neighbors started pooping indiscriminately all over the place. There'd be a huge problem. Viruses would make a roaring comeback, and we'd have a bigger problem. That tsunami that happened, one of their biggest fears was that there would be a lack of clean drinking water and an over-the-top sanitation situation that would have killed thousands of more people.
Can I jump in here? I want to ask you a question. Let's say there's a pond in a park near my house. Might a practical thing to do be make a sign, seemingly like you wouldn't need to, but you just thought to make a sign and stick it in front of this pond that says, you know, this is our only source of fresh water. Do not use this for any other purpose other than drinking. Let's keep this water clean and try to establish a commonwealth in the community for a water source.
That would be a great idea. What would be even a better idea for that is maybe have a neighborhood block plan, you know, like the old McGruff crime dog type things where
right.
your community gets together. That's the first line of defense on communication is, hey, folks, if something happens, and the problem with that, Ian, as you know, is people are going to think, some of you might think, oh, he's a wacko doomsday freak, you know?
And, right.
But it's really just common sense. But if that didn't work and your community was off base, you bet, because guess what's going to happen? People are going to be throwing their poop in there. They're going to be throwing Uncle Fred's dead body in there. I mean, all this stuff is going to happen and worse.
Okay, well, they already think I'm a wacko doomsday freak because I do the show. So that's okay. So, but I think that's an interesting idea, is to try to establish a group, not just a personal or a family psychology, but also a group psychology, a kind of gestalt about survival around the common, whatever your common water source is.
Yeah, that's critical. I mean, everyone needs to be on the same page. And look at the Bosnian-Croatian conflict. People ran to the hills, to the mountain streams to get away from the warfare, and the people above the stream were pooping, and the people that were down low, a lot of kids and infants died from dysentery. And this isn't the 1901. This was just a decade or so ago. There's that much disconnect because we go to the bathroom, the poop hits the toilet, we push a little lever, and it's gone, and we don't have to deal with it. It's a lot like psychology. We don't have to deal with our issues anymore. We let someone else do that. So sanitation is going to be huge. I mean, we put out about a half a pound of fecal material each day. Picture New York City for even a day without working sanitation, and you have a serious setup for potential disease.
All right, now, what about rainwater, too? Let's just assume that, there's some storms coming, and I can reroute my gutters to run into big open vats. Do I still need to boil that water or to distill that water in some way?
Well, it depends on the surface. I had a physician from Ohio in a course of mine a few years ago, and he was stunned when he came to Arizona that he didn't visibly see more people catching rain, because he said his entire community caught rain in above-ground cisterns hidden by shrubbery off regular asphalt shingled roofs, and they didn't even filter it. He said, we drank it as is. So one is the surface, is the surface a bummer? Is it covered with bird poo or whatever? And even just, let's say you caught it in whatever container, you might want to disinfect it. I probably wouldn't, but I'm in a different situation. That's really, really case-dependent. A nice thing for a household to have, I'm going to buy one myself, I don't even have one of these, is the gravity feed filters. There's various makers. I'm not going to pop any one in particular, but you put a gallon or two of water in the house, and it gravity feeds through a filter, and boom, it's ready to drink. So that would be a great thing to do with rainwater or other stuff, and then you're not dealing with funky halogens. It tastes good, and you have the time and luxury to do that. The main thing, like you mentioned, is you got to have something to disinfect first.
Okay, this would be the kind of the commercial grade charcoal filtered water that you pour it in through the, you take the tap water and pour it into the top, and it comes out purified at the bottom.
Yeah, and, right, and there's okay. Various models, and some are, porcelain filters. And yeah, some people just do that right now, but you don't want anything pressurized.
Okay. Now, is there anything else you could do? Is there anything else you can do if you don't have one of those? Can you create one? I mean, can you use charcoal that you set up for the fireplace or anything to use for water filtration?
Yeah, I write about that in my book, about the funky, here's the old Air Force Survival Manual, page 106, that has the pair of jeans, and they're filled with carbon and layers of polyester quilting or whatever, and sand and grass. And so let's say you dump a bunch of water in there, and sure, it's going to filter out. And by the way, some of those filtration methods go back to 2000 BC in ancient Egypt. But are we sure that it's filtered out all these? When you're dealing with filtering, Ian, it's more toxic contamination, which is going to be a big problem. Oil and pesticides and right. Herbicides, and I wouldn't want to waste my time with filtration unless it's the home method we just talked about for like rainwater. It'd be something really funky. So okay, back to this homemade pants thing.
All right, hang on to that. We'll get to it coming up after the top of the hour. Homemade pants, and I want to ask you too about alternative fuels. If you run out of wood, or if you don't have wood, but we'll get into other ideas of survival when all hell breaks loose. Cody Lundeen next on Coast to Coast AM.